You're listening to a Bookmark podcast. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten or omit some of the music chosen by our guests, but we hope you still enjoy listening.
You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
Our aspirations, rather than boasts.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 with me, Lee Chambers. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. And we'll be hearing today from, well, Bookmark's very own sometime presenter and reporter, Menna van Praagh. She's talking about her new magical realist novel, The Witches of Cambridge. And we'll also be speaking to Paul Cartledge on his book about democracy called Democracy a Life. But our studio guest today is Professor Martin Salisbury. He's course director of the Anglia Ruskin University MA in Children's Book Illustration. Hello, Martin.
Hi, hello.
We're going to come back and give you a proper introduction in just a moment, but I just wanted to reflect on the success of the course that you manage, really. It's an exceptionally successful course. I was looking through some of your past alumni, and only this year, your ARU student, Mark Nicholas, was the inaugural winner of the Carmelite Prize, run by Hachette Publishing, with two other ARU students on the Five Strong shortlist. Last year, you had winners of the Macmillan Prize. In fact, ARU students were in the first, second and third position and the Lara Jones Award. And you were just telling me that another of your students was in America recently to pick up an award. Wow, how satisfying is that?
It is deeply satisfying, I must admit. And on top of all those, I just came back from London last night from the Victoria and Albert Museum, where another student, Kate Milner, won the V&A Illustration Prize. So very happy. I'm smug even, I think.
I think you're allowed to be smug. What makes a good illustration course? Why is ARU so good?
Oh, well, I mean, illustration generally, there are many, many courses in illustration, you know, looking at all aspects of illustration. I think the course in children's book illustration as a master's course, I think it's just kind of struck a chord at the right time, in a way, really. It started in, I designed it in 2000, and first intake was in 2001. And I think at that time there was, I think children's book illustration was looked on a little bit as a kind of, you know, a bit of a funny backwater of bunny drawing and not taken so seriously academically. But we had some very good students and it grew and grew. And I think at the same time, the whole interest in the subject has developed. And so it's partly timing and a lot to do with just having had some wonderful students who go on to be published, and then every book that's published usually has a little biography of the author illustrator, and it's studied at Cambridge School of Art at Anglia Ruskin. So it's a sort of, it has its own marketing, I suppose.
Which is, I suppose, why the awards are important. They help to keep the profile of the course high, as well as recognising the art form, if you like, in itself.
Absolutely. And I think the number of awards that there are have increased greatly in recent years, again, in line with greater interest in the subject.
Well, as I say, we'll come back and give you a proper introduction in just a moment. We're going to hear, though, your first choice of music now, which is Tears of Rage by The Band. Why have you chosen this one?
It's a lot of the music I've chosen kind of goes back to my youth in the 70s. I must say I'm not terribly musical.
That's all right.
And I think all of the pieces I've chosen are slightly overwrought and emotional, but this one is all about kind of youth and parenthood and the generation gap, and I've always loved The Band. I went to see them play live, and it's just a great song.
We'll brace ourselves. That's Tears of Rage by the band, the first choice of music from our studio guest today on Bookmark, Professor Martin Salisbury. Martin studied at Maidstone College of Art in the 1970s before working as a freelance illustrator, focusing on fiction and non-fiction for older children. He's taught at Cambridge School of Art for many years and has written a number of books on the practice and theory of book illustration. He's course leader of the MA in Children's Book Illustration at Anglia Ruskin University, a course he designed and which is now recognised as a world-leading programme, producing award-winning illustrators on a regular basis. He speaks on the subject at conferences around the world and has acted as chair of the international jury for the Ragazzi Awards at the Bologna Children's Book Fair. Martin, we're going to talk a lot about book illustration, but I wanted to just find out a little bit more about you and your own journey towards where we are now. Did you always want to be an artist?
I'm not sure that as a child I knew that that was something you could be, really. I always drew. I think all children draw. I think the interesting thing is why so many stop as they get older. I was mostly interested in nature and wildlife and had a childhood very much out in the open air, and I used to draw animals and maps of places, and just so that was my way into drawing. It was much later at school that I realised there was a thing called art school, and then I knew that was all I wanted to do.
And at what point did wanting to be an artist change into wanting to be an illustrator?
I didn't really know the difference as a school kid. I loved comics and illustrated books and things like that. And I thought being an artist just meant you drew, you know. So this idea of a distinction between commercial art and fine art didn't really dawn on me until I got to art school, and then there is kind of a very clear distinction that everybody's keen to make.
And was there one children's book or picture book that influenced you that made you think, yes, that could be a course that I would take in my life?
I didn't come from a particularly bookish family, but we had certain things that I would just pore over endlessly, especially Rupert Bear. Which I get the Rupert Bear annual every Christmas. And I still love them. It was an artist called Alfred Bestall who drew Rupert Bear for many, many, many years, and he was absolutely wonderful. I think he was doing it into his 80s. So I would copy Rupert Bear endlessly, and I suppose that's all part of, leading me towards illustration.
Now, interestingly, because you produced a book called The 100 Greatest Children's Picture Books, Rupert Bear wasn't in there.
Well, it's not really a picture book. The picture book kind of it's quite a specific thing with very few words and telling the story partly through pictures. So
yes, what is the difference between a picture book and a book with illustrations?
A picture book is generally for much younger children, and it delivers its message through a kind of synthesis of words and pictures. Neither of them would make sense without the other. And they are becoming more and more sophisticated in terms of that interplay between words and pictures. Whereas an illustrated book is written as a text, and the text will make perfect sense without the images. And the images are just there to enhance, augment the experience.
And you say it's becoming more and more sophisticated, but it's a very old form of storytelling, isn't it? Pictorial storytelling.
It is. I mean, I suppose you can trace that right back to hieroglyphics on Egyptian walls and cave painting, in a sense. There's some element of narrative to some of those. But the picture book as we know it today, I think, is really kind of, it came into its own in the 1920s, really, as something where the words and pictures weren't saying the same thing.
And I suppose the million-dollar question, what makes a good picture book?
Yes, that is a difficult one. I think, great artwork helps, but it won't redeem a poor concept. I think a lot of people talk from the child's point of view about the kind of the read it again factor. You know, that I know you had one of our graduates, Ellie Dolan, on the show some time back, and Ellie's books are so full of stuff and humour that I think children will just go over them endlessly to find something new every time they pick them up.
Because it is a special relationship, isn't it? I mean, you talked about Rupert Bear then. You know, I remember books that I read in my childhood, Bar Bar the Elephant, which I know is a very important book, that those images stay in your mind.
Absolutely. I think the first books we encounter, especially, just always stay with us. It's kind of a formative time of your life, and the images stay with you. And I guess that's why there seems to be more and more people seeking out on the internet books that they grew up with, that their parents gave away or they lost, and trying to make contact with them again. I think more and more people are collecting older picture books.
So we asked you what was made a good picture book. What makes an outstanding picture book, I suppose? You're a judge for this award, the Bologna Children's Fair, the Ragazzi Award. What are you specifically looking for in an illustration that takes it somewhere else?
That's a difficult one. With something like the Ragazzi Award, it's so international. So, of course, there are books from all over the world. And, of course, we can't read all of them, so we don't know the concept. So the award has to be primarily based on the graphic quality of the book. And it's very difficult to have any kind of shopping list. You know, it's about surprise. It's about, some books can be exquisitely detailed, beautifully drawn. Some are kind of really kind of in-your-face graphic. And it's about innovation. I'm avoiding the question, aren't I?
Well, I think it's hard to pin it down, isn't it? But you just know,
be.
I suppose, when you see it.
Yeah, and there are always several judges, and some will come from a more kind of design perspective, some from a more lyrical perspective. So it's a kind of process of negotiation, and it's not an exact science, I don't think.
And you say that you have entries from writers around the world. I mean, reading up on this subject, it did interest me how different books in different cultures are differently illustrated. In Japan, for example, it's much more specifically artistic, if you like.
Yeah, the cultures are very different around the world. I mean, the Nordic picture books tend to be much more... They don't protect children in any way, so they don't tend to be sentimental at all. They can be quite hard-hitting. I suppose different cultures, it's partly related to their art and design cultures. You know, some places in the Middle East are very rooted in pattern, and so there's all sorts of things that influence the way books are different. I suppose theoretically, in the internet age, they should all end up becoming the same, but I think most countries do like to keep their graphic traditions.
And the values of the writer as well. I know you've written about, say, something like the Moomins and Tove Jansson, how, you know, her liberal background and upbringing influenced the way she drew the creatures.
Yes, I think so, in the way she wrote. But she's so unique, everything about her work, I think, that it's difficult to pin that down specifically to the culture. I think it's just one of those occasional geniuses that emerge.
Wasn't she? Well, we're just going to take a sideways step now, a little bit of a sideways step, because we are going to continue talking about magical realism, I suppose, which is partly what the Moomins are. Mena van Praagh self-published her novella Men, Money and Chocolate in 2008. 9 months after publication, she sold it to Hay House, and so far it's been translated into 26 languages. Her third novel, The Witches of Cambridge, was published by Alison and Busby this year. This and her previous novels are all written in a magical realist style. So I asked Mena, when we met, what it was about magical realism that appealed to her.
I've always loved magical realism. Well, I discovered it when I was a teenager and I read The House of the Spirits, Isabel Allende, and I just loved the idea that there was more to life than there seems to be. I suppose it comes back to that closet in Narnia. And I never forgot that, and I loved that, and I still tap the back of wardrobes because
I've found it.
You know, maybe one day, and it's that whole thing of maybe.
It's a hard one to get right when you're writing, I imagine, because it has to be fantastical but believable.
Yes, it is.
So how do you straddle that line?
I think it's just because I love it so much, so it's in my blood a bit, because those are the books that I love to read. So I've read them, you know, all my writing life. I'm not such a fan of fantasy, I've got to say. People have introduced me to fantasy. And I was, well, that couldn't happen, you know. And I know rationally that magical realism doesn't happen. You know, there aren't ghosts and all of that kind of thing. But I just feel that perhaps there could be. So I take it to that level where it's not quite real, but, you know, maybe this is a possibility.
Well, witchcraft is perfect for that, isn't it? Because there have been witchcraft trials in the past, and generally it's agreed now that witches don't exist. But we all quite like the thought that witches might exist, good witches.
Yes, exactly. You know, it's like taking reality to the next step, because we all have these moments, you know, like psychic moments, where you think of your friend and then they ring a moment later, or strange dreams. You know, I'm pregnant now, and a lot of my, well, three of my friends had a dream that I was having a girl before I knew that I was having a girl. You know, and I know that's not, you know, but nobody dreamt I was having a boy. You know, it was just the moments. And then, so for the witches of Cambridge, I just took it to that little extra step. And then there's the idea that baking or cooking, that we imbue our feelings into that. You know, and that just then takes it to the next level, that you could have a little spell in a biscuit or a cake. And then when someone eats it, they're affected by that.
Well, it's a lovely, charming book. And being set in Cambridge among the rooftops, literally, of Cambridge, that must have been quite inspiring. You get the real sense of the architecture of the colleges.
Yeah, I think a lot of my readers say my love of Cambridge comes through in all my books. I just adore Cambridge. I went to Oxford for 5 years, came straight back to Cambridge. I find it charming and beautiful in a way that I haven't discovered any other place in England to be. My friend Amanda gave me the idea of setting it amongst the turrets of Cambridge. We imagined a witch's book group. They could have their book group meetings on the top of, you know, King's College Chapel and that kind of thing. And then the book took off from there. And cafes, of course, always play a
cafes,
big part.
That's another Van Prague trope, yes. But there is a darker side as well to the book. There's, you know, what happens when you're controlled by a witch, and what happens if you have not a curse as such, but something within you that you can't control.
Yeah, I'd say this is probably the darkest of the books so far. I love when people get really upset or annoyed with the bad character in the book, because of course baddies are the funnest, you know, the most fun characters to write. And I had great fun with Santiago, and yeah, he sort of dabbles in black magic, but he gets his comeuppance. It's a lot of fun. And people say, I hated him. I said, good.
But he's quite sexy as well.
Oh, he's very sexy. He's very sexy. But he's that sort of character where when he steps on, you know he's no good.
You do. It's the peel of the bad boy, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
In terms of, I'm not going to give anything away, but there are some sadder moments in the plot as well. When you were writing it, were you aware of the direction that you were going? And as you say, you were taking it in quite a different direction from your previous work.
Yes, I have an interesting experience with plotting, because all of my novels have strands of different characters, and you have to balance them in this way of bringing in and then connecting them all in some way. But I never like to plot too much, because I find that one of the most magical things for me about writing is the not knowing what's going to happen next. And I think if you don't know what's going to happen next, then your reader doesn't know what's going to happen next. So I have a vague idea, but then, as was the case in this book, I'd had an idea of how the ending might come, and it didn't go that way, you know, and I love that. I always feel with writing that I'm climbing a mountain, and then at some point, usually about sort of 8 chapters before the end, I reach the top of the mountain and I just run down, and it all sort of seems to somehow come together. So far, touch wood.
That's handy. And they're very female based as well, your books. Who is your reader? Is your reader a woman in your head? Are you writing for a particular person?
I write for myself. I don't think you can write for someone else, because how do you know? One, say, 50-year-old woman's not the same as another 50-year-old woman. I mean, you know, sort of 35 to 50, that, you know, it's very hard to say. But I am always rather thrilled when a man picks up the book and reads it and loves it, because I don't think that they have a lot of female characters, but they have male characters in, and they're marketed more as women's fiction, but still they're not, you know, they have murders in them, and they have... I don't feel that they are just for women.
Yeah, there is sadness in them. There is a sense of a story being told and lives being revealed. Who's your favourite character?
Probably Santiago.
I mean, not that I'd want to be friends with him or anything like that. I have a lot of affection for George because he's the, I suppose, the opposite. You know, he's the good boy. But Santiago was just so much fun to be with on the page, you know, because he's so wicked and gorgeous. I mean, what's not to enjoy? True.
You do explore the pain of being different. Did you want to bring that out? The idea that we all might think, how wonderful, we can cast spells, but actually it's not possibly as wonderful as we think it might be.
Yes, because I always had the fantasy that it would be great to have these sort of powers. And particularly, another one of my favourite characters is Noah, and she knows people's secrets, you know, and can basically hear their thoughts. And I thought, gosh, on the one hand, what a great power to have, you know, because I often think you have these misunderstandings with people or you don't know what they're thinking or whatever. And then I thought, gosh, what a nightmare it would be actually to know people so much better than they would know you and then to always feel disconnected from them. So you don't actually feel more intimate, you feel less intimate. And so this is a power that she very much wants to get rid of.
How did you decide on the powers that each character would have?
I think that was just wish fulfillment fantasy. sort of, what would I like to be able to do? And again, there are things that possibly could be. So you have an empath, you know, someone who really feels other people's feelings very acutely, which I do feel other people's feelings, but not to a psychic level, obviously. But it's like you can walk into a room and if someone's just been having an argument, you feel it in the air. There's something. You feel that, you know, and if people are in love, you feel that to a certain extent. And I've been into buildings that have very much have a feeling to them. I remember once walking into a church in Rome and crying. You know, I don't know why I did, but there was something there that is something that you can't really explain.
You're going to read an extract.
One of my favourite moments with Santiago. So, the bad boy of the book. Noah steps inside Santiago's flat. Her Aunt Heather wouldn't like to think that she's gone home with someone she barely knows, someone who claims to have the ability to rid her of the habit she hates most about herself, someone who talks about magic as if it's something he has at his fingertips. The rational, sensible side of Noah is a little nervous. But even though she can't see his secrets, and even though she's not entirely sure she can trust him, when she's looking into his deep brown eyes, she doesn't really care. "Take off your shoes," Santiago says as they reach the end of the hallway. "Of course," Noah says, slipping off her trainers. "Follow me," he says, reaching for her hand. Santiago walks through the living room and into the kitchen, gesturing for Noah to follow. She stares at the shelves, taking in as many mysterious trinkets and magical treasures as she can before they're all out of sight. After the magnificence of the living room, the kitchen is fairly normal, containing all the usual things one might expect and nothing much extra, except for the fact that the cupboards and walls are painted the colours of Santiago's sunsets, dark reds, deep purples and royal blues. "I will make you a tea from Bahia," Santiago says, opening a purple cupboard and plucking out a small tin. "We use dried leaves from various herbs and sweeten it with local honey." "Lovely," Noah says, lacking any better adjectives for a curious concoction she's never tried and only hopes she manages to consume without throwing up. Noah has never had a particularly solid stomach. Santiago pulls open a dark red cupboard and takes out a glass jar. He unscrews the lid, dips in one long, thin finger, and holds it out so his fingertip, coated in thick honey, nearly touches Noah's lip. "This is the sweetest, most delicious honey you will ever taste," he says. Noah looks up. Slowly she opens her mouth, inviting Santiago to slip his finger between her teeth. Her heart beats so fast she can feel it in every inch of her body. Noah curls her tongue around his finger and swallows the honey. And it is, indeed, the sweetest and most delicious honey she's ever tasted.
That's Menna van Praagh there talking about her latest novel, The Witches of Cambridge. It is a page-turner. I do recommend it to you. Well, illustrate that Martin Salisbury illustrate the sweetest, most delicious honey anybody has ever tasted? How would you do that?
Gosh, it sounds, I haven't read it, but it sounds incredibly visual, and the way the author speaks about it is it just filled my head with images, especially the rooftops of Cambridge.
Is that how you think, I guess, as an illustrator? You must think all the time in how would I put this on a page? How would I see this or convey this pictorially?
I suppose so. I mean, I think some people do think visually much more than others, and it's quite an issue for art, practical art subjects in universities, you know, because a lot of things can't be expressed in words. Yeah, it's a different way of thinking and thinking through drawing, I think. And I think it was Saul Steinberg who talked about drawing being a way of reasoning on paper. I think universities are just beginning to come round to that in relation to art schools now.
And Men are talking there about the difficulties of making magical realism believable. And for children's books, that it's very important that it's convincing. I mean, it's obvious. Sometimes is magical realism, isn't it? A children's book, that children fly to the moon and things like that. But it has to have a certain logic or credibility within the illustration.
Yeah, presumably. Exactly. I mean, it can be the most illogical thing, whether it is a character of an elephant like Baba, you know, but it's just setting it up in such a way that you're taken into it and find it believable. I suppose it's setting up a kind of grammar that suspends disbelief. Often the hardest bit, I think, for the picture book maker, we started saying picture book maker because it's not a writer and it's not an illustrator, it's just, you know, you make a book and it kind of comes together through both. But I think the hardest bit is when you go from one world, a sort of world of reality, to a world of fantasy, and it's getting that moment right, that portal. Which I suppose is pretty much the same for writers, really, isn't it? Just making that transition convincing.
And children are interesting readers, aren't they? Because they are very open to lots of ideas, but they're quite critical as well. They'll tell you if something doesn't feel right, doesn't work. They might not be able to say why, but they can say it doesn't feel like it works.
Yeah, or they say it by just putting it down and
yes,
going off to something else. I mean, there's nothing more wonderful than watching a child just in his or her own time, just poring over a book and going back. That's the great thing about the book, as in relation to the screen. You know, you can do it in your own time. It's not dictated to you, and you can go back and have another look. So I don't think the book's going to disappear too soon.
Hopefully not. Well, you mentioned Baba the elephant there, and we mentioned it earlier. Let's talk a little bit about that now. I hadn't realised till I read your books what a seminal and controversial book it was at the time.
The first Baba, yes, by de Bruynhoff Sr. I think there were all sorts of political readings that upset various people, and it's always difficult to know how to react to something like that many years later, you know, because it's of its time.
How were the political readings of Baba?
I think some people felt that it's very imperialist, you know.
Because he's a king.
Yeah, all those kind of issues. And at the time, the situation in Europe at the time, I think, again, it's with the benefit of hindsight we can look back to it, but it's not something that hugely interests me, I have to say.
Well, as a child as well, it went completely over my head, I have to say.
Yeah, quite. They're just kind of extraordinary characters, really, and the expressions don't really change, they are just there, but somehow you're immediately drawn to them.
And very memorable, you know, instantly I can, those blocks of colour, his suit and everything, yeah, you can picture it in a moment.
Yes, beautifully drawn. Of course, after de Bruynhoff Sr. died young, his son took up the work after the war, not until he was quite a little bit older, and carried on the family tradition.
Carried on the elephant line, isn't
it? Yes.
Well, we're going to listen to your second choice of music now, which is Everybody's Talking by Harry Nilsson. Why this one?
Again, I should have thought of the reasons really before I came in. It's just a song that somehow resonates with me. I suppose all these choices, again, are quite narrative. Nielsen, I think, was a great songwriter and storyteller. But, of course, it's also always connected to the film Midnight Cowboy, which is one of my favourite films, and my obsession with New York as I grew up. Of course, when I was younger, you didn't get to travel so much, and I just longed to go to New York, and finally, of course, have been several times.
Everybody's talking at me, I don't hear words they're saying, only the echoes of my mind. People stopping still, I can't see their faces, only the shadows of their eyes.
You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
Yes, you're listening to Bookmark with me, Lee Chambers, and my studio guest today, Professor Martin Salisbury, course leader of the MA in Children's Book Illustration at Anglia Ruskin University. And we were talking just before that wonderful Nielsen track about content and how adults read content perhaps differently from children. In your view, Martin, has what's deemed appropriate content for children, has that changed over the years?
In children's books particularly, I'm not sure. It certainly varies enormously across country borders, as I say. You know, the Scandinavians, you look at picture books for very young children, there it feels almost compulsory to include death, sex, all the things that we tend to protect children from. I think we still, certainly in the UK, have quite a strong, I wouldn't call it censorship, but a kind of set of rules as to what is and isn't appropriate for children.
They are used to cover some big issues. I mean, you know,
yes.
If a relative dies or a pet dies, it's often for a young child to a picture book that an adult will turn first to help them explain.
Yes, that's right. I mean, I think the way things like serious issues are handled in children's books is different in different countries. I mean, we use metaphor a lot, you know, for things like death and loss and grief. One of my graduates, Joe Empson, produced a book a few years ago called Rabbitiness, which had a lot of attention and won a number of awards, which was about death. But there haven't been very many books that have handled it really well, and I thought that one did. It didn't explicitly talk about death, but it was about the space that somebody left when they weren't there anymore. And it was inspired by her own loss of a relative. Close relative. Very serious issues are handled in picture books, but I think often they can be hidden, but can still work very well.
And children can get metaphor, can't they?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. I think there's an awful lot of metaphor in picture books for all sorts of things that children are just beginning to experience.
And implication as well. I think there's a book called My Grandpa where it's all about the child's relationship with the grandpa, and then
yes.
Grandpa's not there on the last page and it's left to...
Oh, the John Birmingham one,
yes.
Yes. I mean, John Birmingham particularly is very good at leaving space for the reader, viewer, to fill with their imagination. You know, he's not afraid to be ambiguous, and that's a very famous one. And, of course, endless academic articles about Birmingham's work because it leaves so much room, space.
Well, he's one of those artists, illustrators that, like Maurice Sendak, like Judith Carr, Quentin Blake, that has a very distinctive style. How do illustrators get to their style? How did they find that?
It's my students always tease me about the fact that I ban the word style.
Oh, do you?
The S word, yeah. Well, I suppose it's because visually, you know, it tends to suggest a kind of conscious mannerism. You know, we use other words like visual language, visual vocabulary. I think the thing is, if you try to develop a style consciously, it becomes just that, as a style. You know, it means a kind of usually kind of a borrowed or constructed way of working. But I think if you work honestly and you draw a lot from observation, it just becomes like handwriting, and gradually the way your work looks becomes recognizable without you realizing it. You know, I mean, they're all so different. John Burningham has never been a natural draftsman. His drawing is always awkward, but it's so kind of from the heart. You know, it's got so much emotion,
and it fits the text as well.
Yes, and most of his picture books are visual texts, if you like, created by him, and he will never use any more words than needed. And as I say, there's always that space between the two, which is the magic, I think.
Lovely. Well, we'll come back to you in a moment. We'll talk about non-fiction as well in a moment, which is appropriate given the next guest, because from 2008 to 2014, Paul Cartledge was A.G. Leventis Professor of Greek Culture at Cambridge University and President of Clare College. He was historical consultant for the BBC series The Greeks and has written and edited numerous books on the ancient Greek world. In the foreword to his most recent book, Democracy, A Life, he admits that this is, in his own words, not his first crack at democracy. So I asked him what it was about this subject that fascinated him.
I suppose it's because ever since I was quite young, I've been a bit of a rebel. So the question of authority has always been something of great interest to me. I was a sort of bad boy, I suppose, both at school and at university. And so the question of who was in a position to have a say, set the rules, that always interested me. As I got older and became, in other words, a voting age, you start to think, OK, what are the issues? And I suppose some people are just political, and I'm inherently political.
And you've called it Democracy, A Life. It's a history of democracy, but it's more than that, isn't it? It's an in-depth study of its effects as well. It's very thorough. Did you have that in mind when you started out? This was what it was going to be.
It was always going to be long-run history, comparative history. And actually the word itself was one of the major motivators, because it means in its original signification people power. But then the question is, what people, which people, and what sort of power? And then the next thing that struck me when I was comparing and contrasting ancient Greek with any modern system was how different, how, in fact, almost radically opposite the two constructions, the two interpretations of democracy were. We take it that we, you and I, as citizens, don't rule on a day-to-day basis. We have a say, that's to say we have a vote, but we exercise it only very occasionally, and we don't actually have much direct day-to-day control over those whom we elect to be our representatives. Well, the ancients would have considered that system a form of oligarchy, because we're choosing our rulers, but not actually making them responsible to us. And they are ruling instead of us. I mean, there are all sorts of other differences. Women were not considered politically eligible. That's to say, they were deemed to be at law always inferior to men. And in this sense, they never had a public political presence. Secondly, ancient Greeks, of course, based in a way their whole outlook on life on having slaves. And slaves typically were not Greeks. So they had this notion that it's okay to enslave foreigners. It's not so good to enslave Greeks, though actually some Greeks were slaves. So there are such fundamental differences that it doesn't actually easily translate the term from antiquity to modernity.
And can you pin down the point at which it started to change?
After Athens becomes a democracy, and that notion that ordinary people might actually rule themselves, that spreads. The Greek world was enormously varied. What we call Greece today was just the eastern end of the Greek world, which extended all over the Mediterranean, and indeed a large part of the Black Sea. And then after Alexander the Great's conquests, it extended as far east as Pakistan and Afghanistan. And within that Greek world, there were about 1,000 different political communities, about a quarter of whom, I suppose, at any time were any form of democracy. democracy differed from city to city. Athens had a very radical version and others had more moderate versions and so on. Well, within that period of ancient democracy, there's a big cut-off, and it is indeed with Alexander the Great, when Greeks typically no longer were independent. They were subjects to big territorial monarchies, of which there are only three or four. So the big thing was to not be directly ruled by some outsider, to continue to rule yourself. And in that sense, you could call yourself a democracy in a more moderate sense. You ruled yourself, but nevertheless, you ceased to be a people power. That is, the masses, the poor, no longer had the decisive say.
So democracy now, we think of it as a good thing. We think of it as an empowering thing. Have we been sold a lie?
We haven't, in this sense that it is empowering. I mean, look around the world, and the term has been watered down. So we have what we call a democratic deficit. In other words, you and I don't actually have much real control. And sometimes our governments do things which we, or at least most of us, really would rather they hadn't. And most recent, I suppose, example of that is the invasion of Iraq in 2003. That's a kind of tipping point. There are a lot of us who, if we'd been asked, would have said, it would be crazy to go in. I mean, it's really bad judgment to do that. The whirlwind you're going to reap is not something that you should look forward to. But it happened. So we are, on the other hand, not living under a very managed, quotes, democracy, such as they have in, for example, Russia and China. There's a great deal more individual freedom, freedom both of action and thought, in our part of the Western world. And there are many countries I can think of that I'd very much not want to live in.
You say at the end of the book that you're actually very pessimistic about the future of democracy.
I'm pessimistic. It's an odd thing to say, because with modern media, we can consult each other, we can communicate with each other much more frequently, much more seemingly intimately. So in principle, let's take the current EU referendum. Well, the ancient Greeks were completely familiar with the idea that a major issue, it comes before the people, a majority vote, everybody gets one vote, that is the decision. But they did it pretty much every 10 days. We do it once in a blue moon, and it's a really big deal, and we're not actually educated to do it, and we're not geared to do it. Our system is a parliamentary democracy, and if we then go for a direct democracy, which is what a referendum, that's a sign of failure, not a sign of success. So I'm pessimistic because I think there's not enough trust in us. We're not sufficiently often consulted. I mean, give you another example, Trident. Should we not be consulted as to whether we believe we should maintain that nuclear deterrent or put the equivalent sum of money into some other cause, and for obvious reasons in this country, something like the National Health Service? But we're never consulted in that way, and it's in that sense that I'm pessimistic.
But do you think there's not an enthusiasm among the people for continuous referendums either?
There isn't an enthusiasm for that, and that's partly because it's such a big deal. It's very expensive. There's a much too long run-up to it. And this is my other bugbear in modern democracy, which is the party system. I have a party preference, but occasionally that party does things I absolutely abhor. So I would like us to get much more back to the ancient system where there are no parties and people vote as individuals. Of course, they've got various pressures. They come from particular families, backgrounds, wealth, you know, all that. We're not free. No one is ever free completely. But one of the oppressive elements of our current system is the party system.
That's not going to be dismantled, though, is it? I mean, what you're describing sounds lovely, but realistically, are we ever going to get to that situation?
It isn't. What can be done, I think, is to moderate it. So, for example, in Iceland, they had a system of selecting by lot a bunch of people to serve as a kind of constitutional watchdog, so that any measure proposed by the parliament would then be put to this group of people, vetted, then they'd have a vote, then it would go back to the parliament. And I believe in Iceland they actually empowered this sort of second, it's like a second chamber, but of course our House of Lords, which is supposed to be a revising second chamber, is part of the party system. It's not completely independent from the House of Commons.
Do you think you're ever going to get a perfect system to govern a country and millions of people? Every system has its flaws.
Correct. Politics, as someone said, is the art of the possible, and so one must not be excessively utopian. On the other hand, I think some utopianism is actually quite a good thing, because if you don't imagine that something could be very much better than it is, then probably you're never going to be motivated to really want to try to introduce major changes, which I think we do need.
And you've spoken about how you feel inclusion of religion and human rights in the debate has muddied the waters.
It has, though of course that's exactly what politics should be about. But in the same way that parties, they have to toe a party line, well, I'm very concerned that religious sectarian interests might be allowed to have some sort of decisive say. I just do believe that one should keep the political space ultimately a secular space, and that they will deal with religious issues, but religion should not dominate. Politics should dominate religion.
And you've said you're pessimistic about the future, but if I ask you to think maybe in 50, 100 years' time, do you think we'll still have this same system, or do you think it will have changed?
I think it's probably going to rattle on, because short of a revolution, I don't think there's going to be any great desire to overthrow parliamentary democracy. We have a very funny compromise, and it could be improved. The House of Lords could be selected on a different basis. We could maybe think of different ways of electing MPs. In other words, first past the post is certainly up for grabs, as opposed to proportional representation of one kind or another. Perhaps I'm very conservative now in my old age, but I don't actually think there's going to be a great popular uprising to overthrow the whole system as such.
And PR, do you think that is more democratic?
It is and it isn't. I mean, it is, because it distributes artificially votes more in accordance with preferences. But actually, in my opinion at any rate, when you vote for a party or vote for a person, it's not that you necessarily tick every single box of that person's manifesto, that party manifesto. So you would really need to disaggregate votes. I vote, but my vote is not a single thing to be transferred. Therefore, this present system, which is crude, nevertheless, it gives fuller weight to you. Your one vote has more weight than if it were to be distributable.
And you've written this very thorough book on democracy. Are you done now on this subject, or do you think you will keep going on it?
Well, I am done for the time being, but it's something that's not just part of my work, but it's part of my life. I mean, democracy, a life, it's a life of an idea and a thing, but it's also my own life. So I shall continue to try to be a radical Democrat.
That's Paul Cartledge there talking about his book Democracy, A Life, a non-fiction book, with Professor Martin Salisbury from the MA in Children's Book Illustration at Anglia Ruskin University. Do you cover non-fiction in your course?
Yes, absolutely. We're trying really to get students more interested in it, because there is still, I think, a perception amongst the students that non-fiction is less creative. But the last few years, it's been a boom area for picture books. You probably know the last two or three years, after declining sales in books for many, many years, picture books have led the revival, and sales of picture books have gone up 5 or 6% year on year for the last 2 years. But non-fiction picture books have shot up 30% in sales. But I think that the line between fiction and non-fiction has been blurred a little bit, in that a lot of essentially non-fiction books are using narrative techniques to deliver information, you know, so character-based and this kind of thing. So it's a really interesting area at the moment.
I'm interested it's gone up by that much. Actually, you would have thought the opposite in this age of the internet, where you can sit a child in front of a screen and say, this is what a dinosaur looks like, or...
I think perhaps it's connected to the way that children's books and picture books have had to reinvent themselves in the last few years, and have become much more physically tactile, beautifully produced, with all sorts of embossing and beautiful papers and things like this, so that it becomes something that you really want to own. And big books are all the rage in non-fiction. A few years ago, publishers were all saying, oh, you can't sell big books to the British public. We don't know how to display them, and they cost too much. Nobody's going to spend £20 on a picture book. But I think it maybe started with the the book called Maps by the Polish husband and wife couple, whose name I can't remember, and if I could, I couldn't pronounce it. And that sold 100,000 copies, and it was, it sort of came from nowhere, and it's a really big book and beautifully produced book. So, yeah, it seems to be a bit of a golden age for non-fiction at the moment.
So the future is good as far as you're concerned for picture books, fiction and non-fiction?
Well, it looks a lot better than it did about 5 years ago when everybody was predicting doom and gloom for books generally and picture books particularly. It's a very exciting time at the moment. Whether the whole area will continue to grow, who knows, but it feels very healthy.
Well, it's been lovely talking to you, Martin. Thank you so much. Congratulations on the success of the course. Long may it continue. We'll play your last piece of music in just a moment, but just a look ahead to the next show. Our studio guest will be Marnie Riches. She's a crime thriller writer, described as a homegrown Stieg Larsson. We'll also have interviews with Emily Winslow on her book Jane Doe January, which is a memoir about a sexual assault, and an interview with Ben Kane, who writes military historical fiction. So another eclectic show for you there. If you want to listen to any of the old bookmarks, then go to the Cambridge 105 website, which is cambridge105.fm, and all our old shows are up there since the beginning of time, really. But we're going to sign out now with your last choice of music, Martin, which is the Adagietto, I think that's how you pronounce it, from Mahler's Symphony No. 5. Why this one?
I think I'm just realising that there is a connection between the music and the art, if you like. I have a keen interest in romanticism in the arts, and particularly the neo-romantic artists just after the Second World War, John Piper and John Minton, who I'm writing a book about at the moment. And it's that whole kind of, they were all interested in the sort of tragic, you know, and this is the most overwrought piece of music of all of them. And of course, it was used in the film The Death in Venice, the Thomas Mann short story. And it's just the saddest piece of music.
You do like your intense emotions, don't you?
Yes, I've got to wallow in it now.
Let's wallow.